This is an ABC podcast.
Malolele, manuia le taiao, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We'd like to acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Also, there is some exciting news. That's right, Transmitter is up in Palau. So we say ali and warmly welcome our new listeners from Palau who are tuning in via 91.5 FM. Hopefully you had a great weekend as we kickstart off your Monday morning. On the show, Palau, they beef up their security operations with the Guam National Guard. We continue our coverage on Kiribati's removal of the Australian High Court Judge David Lambourn. And it's only been a week in the job for the new Solomon Islands Prime Minister, Jeremiah Manele. We want to get a bit of an insight into how he will fare. So we'll be talking to former Prime Minister Danny Phillip this morning. More on those stories shortly. And when you want to know a little bit more on our stories, you can simply type Pacific Beat Radio Australia into your search engine and feel free to share these stories across your social media platforms. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram via ABC Pacific. I'm your host, Aggie Tupou, and you're tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, though, Pacific nations have some of the toughest abortion laws in the world, but some are trying to change that. Many women risk jail to terminate a pregnancy, and some face even greater dangers. While heated debate about abortion takes place in other parts of the world, in the Pacific, strict cultural taboos mean it's rarely discussed. Marion Farr has this report, and a warning, it contains some distressing details.
Florence clearly remembers the moment she found out she was pregnant for the third time. We've changed her name and voice for legal reasons.
I could feel my palms again sweating, my heart's beating faster, there's a whole blood rush.
The child's father said he wanted nothing to do with the baby.
It's a lot of humiliation and I felt like a big disappointment. So I start to look around for ways to have an abortion.
She found someone on Facebook who said he was a medical doctor who performed secret abortions.
He said, don't worry, you're in safe hands. So this is what's going to happen. You're going to drink two. So I had to take pills. You're going to take it orally. And then the other two, I will have to insert it vaginally. And he opened up the door to his room. We went there. And that's when he sexually abused me.
Florence alleges the doctor raped her twice while performing the procedure.
Being in there, my body completely shut down and froze.
She reported the alleged abuse to police, but there's been no court verdict. Florence believes Vanuatu's strict abortion laws put women's lives at risk.
It's these men that put themselves at this position, claiming themselves that they are here to support these women to go through that, and yet they're abusing them.
Across the Pacific, abortion is highly restricted. In most countries, it's only permitted to save a woman's life. Some nations, like Palau and Tonga, ban the practice entirely. In Vanuatu, where Florence lives, it's allowed when there's a good medical reason. Advocates, like Julia Senabulia, want these laws reviewed.
Especially cases like if someone is raped, defiled, you can imagine that trauma. But trauma is not anywhere in the law, so we cannot do anything.
He runs the Vanuatu Family Health Association. Its busy clinic in the heart of Port Vila receives requests for abortion every day.
So we're trying to provide family planning, contraception. It's not enough. We're trying to do awareness. It's not enough.
But trying to change attitudes in a country with deep religious roots isn't easy. Kalarip Sope is the assistant chief of Pungo Village. He says even in cases of rape or incest, abortion is taboo.
You cannot kill a child. You cannot kill a person. And that's the belief.
The ABC asked the Vanuatu government about the issue, but we haven't received a response. Yasmin Bjornum, who runs a feminist media organisation called Sister, says mothers often bear all the responsibility for unplanned pregnancies.
And even if she is in a relationship with the guy, she's still financially responsible. Her family is responsible. So what is the role of the father?
She wants women in the Pacific to be able to access safe abortions, even if it means setting aside her personal views.
I believe that if you want one, your right to have one is more important than my belief. It doesn't matter what we believe.
For Florence, that could have made a world of difference.
This experience in this situation that I've been through, it was all unsafe abortion. And that's what I don't want for any of the women out there.
And that is Florence, ending that report by Marion Farr, with additional reporting by Monique Sangle and Nikki Atukualtonga. This reporting was supported by the Sean Dorney Grant for Pacific Journalism through the Walkley Foundation. Pacific Beat. And we head to Palau, where they don't have their own military force, but it now has something similar following a new partnership with the Guam National Guard. The partnership will enhance security operations between the Micronesian states and shore up Palau's disaster response capabilities. Carl Evans spoke to Palau President Serangel Whips Jr. about the benefits.
When I first got into office in 2021, my first visit to Guam, I met with Governor Guerrero. She recommended that we get this partnership going, building on the already historical relationship that Palau and Guam has, whether it's the people, the migration, but just another opportunity for us to work together. And so having the National Guard and the state partnership just, I think, enhances these opportunities to help in areas of security, surveillance, and just with police maybe augmenting or other activities. But the other side is also the humanitarian side, helping us when there's disasters.
Yeah, look, we'll talk about some of those responsive capabilities in a second. I guess just firstly, for people around the Pacific who might not be too familiar, who are the Guam National Guard, and I guess how do they differentiate between, you know, your average U.S. Marine, I suppose?
I'm still learning more, actually. Next Friday, I'll be going to visit the National Guard Center there on Guam to learn more about the capabilities of how they can help us. But they are, my understanding is, reserves. So, you know, they're not full-time active duty military. They're the reserves. And so they're activated when they, of course, they need them. But at the same time, they're constantly doing training. And so that training, those training opportunities, you know, you can also do some of those in Palau. And part of coming to Palau is training and just enhancing their capability. So that's where the opportunity comes.
Yeah, interesting. And in terms of their responsive capabilities, what kinds of, I guess, future disasters do you anticipate? And has there been instances where, you know, you've fallen short in a particular area and now going forward that you'll be much more better equipped?
Oh, well, for sure, when you have typhoons. Typhoons are, they just cause damage and chaos and everything. You're out of water, you're out of power, you're how to manage people and get them help. And so just having extra hands, being able to be capable to fly in and help us, that would be a great benefit. I know one time we had a drought and U.S. military sent a team in to help us with like desalination or engineering capability. You know, they can do things like that. The other thing that we discussed is they have helicopters on Guam, the possibility of bringing one of those to Palau to also do surveillance, and but at the same time, if there's humanitarian like search and rescue or a health emergency, they could also help in those. So a lot of different, I think, opportunities really to just to provide better service to our people. And
what about in terms of economic benefits? Will there be troops that who now stay permanently within Palau, or there will there be logistic benefits or anything like that?
Well, I think, yeah, especially the trainings, of course, we welcome, because when they come, they stay in hotels and they're there for a while. So they're in restaurants. So that's always another benefit that these exercises have.
And I guess just finally, when you talk of training benefits, would that be the Guam National Guard training emergency response workers within Palau?
Well, I think it's both. It's for them to upgrade their capability. At the same time, when they're, you know, working alongside with our people, they also help our people upgrade their skills. So it's both.
And that was Palau President Serangel Whips Jr. speaking with Carl Evans. Stay with us on Pacific Beat, because on the show we will be returning to Palau for more on an aviation announcement.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
As Solomon Islands' new Prime Minister, Jeremiah Manele, begins his first week in office, all eyes will be on how the first-time PM will fare. Mr. Manele is the first Prime Minister from the province of Isabel and is a career diplomat before he was elected into office last week. One man who's no stranger to the top job and served as Prime Minister in 2010 is Danny Phillip. Mr. Phillip served alongside Manele over the past 5 years until he lost his South New Georgia Rendova Titipari seat last month. So joining us on the line from Honiara this morning is Danny Phillip. With that I say, good fellow morning, Mr. Phillip.
Good morning to you.
Thank you very much for joining us. Were you surprised that Jeremiah Manele was chosen to be the Our Party's candidate for the PM's election?
No, I wasn't, because I think when during my short stint as Prime Minister in 2010-11, he was my the secretary to the Prime Minister during that time. And I know of his capacity, his intelligence, and his commitment to work. And so I could see, and in fact, I encourage him to pursue a political career after his not many years of experiences he had in international relations at one stage, you know, permanent representative in New York.
Well, it does sound like you say he already has the capacity to be a good prime minister. Yeah, can I ask, though, how do you rate Manele's ability to run the country, though?
I'm very confident. He will be a little different from Manasseh, though. I serve under Manasseh as well in a number of he's the longest-serving prime minister in this country. And Manasseh is a strong, very strong personality. And obviously, you guys down in Sydney, and the Pacific as a region, with the current issues of geopolitics here in the region, would know that he's a very strong personality. And he was able to get the government through. In fact, not 4 years, but 5 years, the first ever full term that he has been the Prime Minister here in this country. So Jerry is a little bit, he's much more conscientious in terms of being able to listen and to be able to work very closely. He's it's much more inclusive personality. In terms of working together with his cabinet, not that Manasseh didn't do that, but in some occasions, he's a very confident person, and so I think we'll see how it goes. But I have full confidence in Jerry to be able to lead this country forward.
Now, Danny, we know that the PM's job is not only about the technical capabilities, right? But how do you think he'll be at managing a cabinet and caucus, as we know, is made up of a very vast number of players with very different agendas?
Obviously, that has always been the problem with Solomon Islands politics for many, many years. And in post-conflict ethnic uprising here in the Solomon Islands, I became the Prime Minister for a very short time, but it gave us so much difficulties in trying to run a government of national unity of some sort, even during my time. And so the instability within cabinet, people switching sides and all that kind of thing has been going on during my time. So, I hope that the current situation will be maybe affected by the many number of factions in the government. I think, but the majority of the members of parliament in this formation is from the our party candidates. We have People First, and I think Kandere Party has got one member, a single survivor of that party, and also a number of independents. And so those are elements within the current formation that needs to be in. And I haven't seen made an appointment with Jerry, but I will sit down with him and see how we can organize.
Denny, can I ask though, because you did mention new Prime Minister Manele is very much conscientious, is a listener, inclusive, is confident. But if we take it back to the former Prime Minister, Manasi Songovare, do you believe he's a bit of a team player? Do you feel he'll hand over the reins easily and let Manele lead, though?
Yeah, I don't think the threat will come from Manasi. I think you were quite right in saying Jerry's ability to be able to hold the coalition together. I'm sure Manasseh will give his full support. In fact, Jerry was nominated by him and plus one other. And so I'm fully confident that the working together situation in the current formation will last, will hold. But I also warned in one of my posts in the Facebook in congratulating Manele to warn him of the number of perhaps if you like sheep wolves in sheep clothing or skin. So that's something to watch out from. Yeah. So.
Well, yeah, let's look into that because yes, you did warn Manele of sheep's and wolves' clothing. What did you actually mean by that?
Well, there are a number of independents in the group. And as you know, we also have, I think during the election of the Prime Minister, there are three others who have cast their votes for Manele. We don't know where they come from. And whether they will be part of the coalition, I am not too sure. But that will be something that the coalition will have to consider doing. And so, yeah, with the nature of Solomon's politics, within government formations, that's where the cracks usually come from. And so, yeah, we need to watch.
Thank you for that. If you're tuning into Pacific Beat, I'm your host, Aggie Dewol. Speaking to former Vanuatu Prime Minister in 2010 was Danny Philip, someone who knows all too well what it's like to lead his country and his thoughts on the new Prime Minister, Jeremiah Manele. When it comes to geopolitics in China, we do know that Songovare was very pro-China. Do you expect Manele to be the same, or you feel he'll be a bit more measured?
In the last Songovare government, I was the chairman of the Foreign Policy Advisory Secretariat, and one of my job is to form to strike a balance or an equilibrium on foreign policy. That is very important. The fact that we become friends with China doesn't mean that we become enemies of our other traditional friends. So we would like to keep the equilibrium as long as we can. Now, unfortunately, the rivalry between USA and China is very, very much pronounced at the time when we make the switch over to Beijing, and that's something that is becomes a challenge to Solomon's politics.
Do you think that relationship with China will change at all?
I don't think so for the moment. What we need to do is to contain China in some way or form, that is feasible for our needs. And that is not easy to handle. China is such a huge country, and it's the second largest economy in the world now. And but this is our country, and it is important for us to know, to put our priorities, our interests first before China's interest, and to try and make sure that we keep a friendly relations with our traditional friends such as Australia and New Zealand and Australia in this region, as well as making sure that we gain benefits from China's huge economic and trade capacity.
And I just want to check with you, are you aware of Manila being able to finalise his cabinet? Was that able to be done over the weekend?
I'm sure he will, yes. I think he already appointed 11 of chief ministers, and I think he's gauging the formation. In this country, it is important to make sure that everybody is represented in a diverse society like Solomon Islands. So that also can make or break a government. And I think he's very careful in measuring up to some of these things that possibly can affect the stability of the government.
Absolutely. Mr. Phillips, we really do appreciate your time this morning just to give us a bit of an insight into how the new Prime Minister will fare in his new season as Prime Minister. So we thank you again for your time this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
No worries. That, of course, is former Solomon Islands Prime Minister, Danny Phillip. Up soon, we've got your news wrap with producer Mackenzie Smith.
What's it like for those on the front lines of science across the Pacific? Pacific Scientific returns with more incredible stories. Trek to a remote beach to witness baby turtles hatch.
Oh my gosh, that's like the most beautiful thing I've ever seen on this island.
And tinker in a robotics workshop.
There is no backup plan, I'm all in with this. It's do or die.
Pacific Scientific, Tuesday at 9 a.m. PNG time, right here on ABC Radio Australia.
Kia ora na, and welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie DeBoll. And yes, it's that time where we head around the region to get the latest headlines with your news wrap that's brought to you by our producer, Mackenzie Smith. With that, I say good morning, Mackenzie.
Morena, Aggie.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. We head to the Cook Islands because there's a debate over legislation that would ban e-cigarettes.
Yeah, the Cook Island News reports a bill will be tabled this month that would ban the import, sale and distribution of all imitation tobacco products. That's including both nicotine and non-nicotine e-cigarettes and vapes. Now, the restrictions would only apply to residents in the Cook Islands. Tourists would still be able to bring in small quantities for personal use. But the Cook Islands News spoke to business owners, including one who was concerned the laws would fall hardest on small businesses in the country who face a fine of up to $1 million if they are found selling the products.
Wow. We head to an American restaurant chain, that has trademarked the word cover with a C. Interesting story. What's happening there?
Yeah, a bit of a tough one for radio, but the Fiji Times reports the Florida-based company has trademarked Carver Group Incorporated with a C, but the move has raised concerns because of the word's similarity to Carver spelt with a K, as we would usually see it. The outgoing Secretary General of the Pacific Islands Forum, Henry Puna, told the newspaper he had recently raised concerns with the World Intellectual Property Office in Geneva. He says the name Carver belongs to the Pacific people and should remain so.
That's a tricky one, isn't it? Okay, well, Vanuatu, this is a really good piece to hear. Is the happiest place in the world? No surprises there.
No, Vanuatu came out on top of the Happy Planet Index for 2024. That's out of 150 countries, and it's the second time it's led the ranking since 2006. So the index measures a mixture of human well-being and environmental impact in an attempt to decenter economic-focused rankings. Vanuatu was recognised for providing a high standard of health and well-being while limiting the average carbon footprint per capita.
That is good news. Did you have any chance of knowing where New Zealand or Australia stood?
No, but I know that the US was the lowest among the developed world.
Again, that feels like no surprises there for that one. But hey, maybe we should head to Vanuatu. But Mackenzie, we really appreciate your time this morning.
No worries.
That is Mackenzie Smith with our news wrap here on Pacific Beat. Now, the United Nations top human rights expert says the rights of judges must be upheld in order to ensure there's justice for everyone. The special rapporteur on the independence of judges and lawyers has made the comments after Kiribati's parliament voted to remove an Australian-born High Court judge from office. The vote comes after a tribunal report recommended the dismissal of suspended judge David Lambourne. Justice Lambourne, who is married to the country's opposition leader, has been given 21 days to appeal, after which he is facing deportation if he does not leave earlier. Dubravka Volodya asked the UN's Margaret Satterthwaite to outline her concerns.
The concerns come about both from the circumstances of the original charges against him and then the process that was used by these different tribunals. Very much did not follow what would be called natural justice or due process guarantees that are required under human rights law. So just as an example, not having the opportunity to attend every hearing of the tribunal, not being able to cross-examine witnesses against you, not being able to bring in observers. These are just some of the concerns that arose in this setting. But the broader context, I think, is the really big concern, which is the manner in which Justice Lambourne was brought up for these charges appears to be political. And the reason I say that is he is married to the head of the opposition political party. And it's always a concern in any country when you see a potential political issue combined with a failure to provide due process. It's quite a toxic combination. And it really leads to human rights violations in a lot of circumstances. So in this case, what I'm concerned about is that Justice Lambourne did not get a fair hearing and that he's being removed from his judge appointment, essentially as a political move by the government.
Now, there were a few charges against him and only one was upheld. What do you think about that charge being upheld, and would that justify the steps that the government is taking?
Under international standards, the removal of a judge should only be for their incapacity to undertake their duties or for serious misbehavior. So what we have to ask is, were these charges one or both of those two things? And the charges that he was found to have been liable for were to have delayed a judgment. Now, delaying a judgment is something that you see in a lot of cases in jurisdictions in every part of the world. I mean, probably every single jurisdiction has seen a delayed judgment at some point. Here in the U.S., we have something called the six-month list, where if a judge has had a decision that's been outstanding for 6 months, they appear on a list. And then the idea is to kind of ensure that they get off the list next time and that they continue to move forward with their cases. So it's a normal thing to happen. It is very unusual and strikes me as quite inappropriate to turn that into a disciplinary problem. The delay is an administrative problem. It's potentially an issue of management. It might be an issue of workload. You know, we don't know all of the reasons. But turning that into a disciplinary infraction is very, very troubling. And it's important, I think, for all of us to remember that the purpose of the Kiribati justice system is to serve the people of Kiribati. It is not to ensure the rights of judges, but judges' rights must be upheld in order to ensure that there's fair justice for everyone. And so it's very, very concerning that what appears to be a political concern, or I don't even want to call it a dispute, but a political effort, has now landed the entire people of Kiribati in a place where they can't seek justice before the courts functionally.
In terms of judges in the Pacific, and I'm sure in many other countries as well, we are seeing that a lot of the judges in Kiribati and also in some other countries are from Western countries. So in Justice Lambourne's case, Australia, we also had, you know, judges who serve from New Zealand. And some have criticized that as saying, you know, this is a remnant from the colonial past and the countries should have their own judges. What's your view on that, on that sort of criticism? And could that play into it as well?
The first thing I want to say is I think these are very important issues. It's extremely important to think about who should be judges in any society, in any culture, in any political jurisdiction. So that's a crucial question. And there's no question that, unfortunately, many judicial systems are marred by colonialism. And that's something I can again say, even here in the United States, we still have remnants of colonialism in our system, and it's something that we're working through. So I am quite sympathetic to those concerns. However, if there will be a transition away from judges who are from Western countries, it must be done in a transparent manner, in a manner that affords due process to judges who are sitting in their current positions, and in a way that is not political. So it needs to be through a process that is legal, transparent, and with due process. One other thing I'll say about this is it's not unusual, of course, for very small countries to need to have foreign judges on their national courts. And that happens in other regions as well. And I think it's also something to be often celebrated. It's a place where judges can learn from each other across different jurisdictions. So I don't think that that in itself is a problem at all. I think actually it could be something we would celebrate. I do understand the concerns around colonialism or around cultural, inappropriately cultural fit, perhaps one might say, but that's not something that arises overnight and must be solved by removing judges in a way that doesn't comport with due process. So I would hope that this discussion could not be politicized and utilized as a way of getting rid of judges, but instead there could be a real public debate within Kiribati, within other countries, and an open discussion of if there is an issue that we'd like to change, how should we do this in a way that's fair?
In terms of Justice Lambourne getting back to that issue, what are his options now? Because I think he's been given 21 days to appeal, or he will be deported. What's the next step?
I think he's in a very difficult position. I'm certainly calling on the government to give him a visa and to ensure that he can stay and pursue an appeal if that's what he chooses to do. I think it's very hard to predict, and so I won't try to predict, but one would assume that he would have a right under the Constitution to appeal this decision and to look into the issues of due process that are underlying the concern. So I don't know what will happen. I hope that it will be something that will allow Judge Lambourne to vindicate and advance his rights, and also for the people of Kiribati to see justice done in a transparent way.
And that was UN's special rapporteur on the independence of judges and lawyers, Margaret Satterwaith, talking to Dubravka Volodia.
Nijam Footy, hosted by me, Sam Wykes,
and me, Tenero Aruna. Each week, we'll bring you Pacific Islander stories from on and off the rugby league and rugby union field.
We'll have plenty of special guests, tales from the past, tackle the big topics of today, and look forward to the next-gen Nijam Footy stars.
Nijam Footy. Nijam Footy.
Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time
on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie the Bowl. Well, the Australian government has been working to open up and expand diplomacy in the Pacific. And today, they've announced direct flights will run from Australia to the island nation of Palau for the first time. The Pacific has become the centre of a diplomatic contest between the West and China, with Palau one of three countries warning the US it could seek help elsewhere when a funding deal providing millions of dollars to Palau was dragged out for months in the US Congress. At the time, Palau even urged Australia to intervene. So President Sarangal Whoops Jr. spoke to ABC's Sally Sara this morning about the plans.
Oh, I think it'll just open up new opportunities. Really, our goal was, after COVID, was to build back better and diversify our tourism industry. And Australians, I think, are adventurous. They know they care for the environment, and Palau, with the pristine environment that we have and the unique culture and just what makes Palau special, I think has something to offer Australian tourists. And we're just hoping that this provides opportunity for tourists, but also for business, for trade, and really more deeper people-to-people relations. So we're excited. We've been working with your government to get this off the ground, and we're just so excited that this announcement today that finally it's happening. Direct flights from Australia to Palau. There are flights that were going through Port Moresby and going through Nauru and around, but this will be direct. So we hope to see a lot more vacationers coming up our way.
Mr. Whips, what does the figures tell you at the moment about where tourists are coming from to Palau? I know you've had a lot of Japanese coming through with World War II tourism. Where are most of the tourists coming from at the moment?
Unfortunately, the number one market is still China. As you know, we're only 5 hours from most of Asia, 3.5 hours from Macau, which we have a lot of flights that come in from Macau. Taiwan is another major destination. We have three flights a week, soon to have four flights a week. And then we have daily flights from Guam. So those are the main hubs now. The Guam flights bring the Japanese tourists, but we're hoping that maybe with this connection with Australia, it'll open up new markets from coming off from Australia, then on to Japan and vice versa, kind of being the, you know, connecting Asia through Palau to Australia and back and forth, and may open up those other markets like Korea and Japan, maybe Thailand or Singapore. So we're hoping that this will be the beginning of maybe more to come in the future.
In March this year, the US passed the Compacts of Free Association, which will provide around $10 billion to Palau, Marshall Islands and the Federated States of Micronesia over 20 years. This money was delayed in the US Senate, and before it finally passed, you said that you wouldn't want to go to China, but if Washington kept delaying, you need to go to China and say, well, we're here. What do you think about the delays? And what did it do for Palau's relationship with the United States, in your view?
Well, I just want to correct. That's not what I said. I said what the delays are causing the people of Palau to question the relationship. And when people question the relationship, you know, that the integrity, the friendship is tarnished. And so what we want to do is, you know, we have the momentum going. People trust in the system. I know sometimes democracy doesn't work as smoothly as you want, but we still have faith that it's going to get done. And at the end, in March, it got done. Of course, it was 6 months delayed, but in time for what Palau really needed to do, build that solid and resilient foundation, try to help us get out of the debt we incurred during COVID and put us on the right track to hopefully continue to diversify our economy and get us going. But yes, there's no question. The Chinese are constantly wooing us with different opportunities. For example, the sky's the limit. You want a million tourists? I can give you a million tourists. You want to, I'll build all the hotels you need to do that. You need a call center? We'll build a call center, give you $20 million a year. All these wooings have always been there. And of course, what they do is other leaders in Palau then say, well, really, do we need to be this tied to the United States? And then they question. But, you know, I think most importantly for the people of Palau, from World War II till now, have a strong affiliation with the United States. We share the same values. We believe in freedom and democracy. We believe in a free and open Indo-Pacific. And really, partners need to support each other. They need to build strong partnerships. And we truly believe that we're stronger together. And Australia is an important partner. And that's why Australian tourists coming to Palau are important in helping build that resilient economy so that we're not so dependent on one market. And that's really our goal. So to work with the Australian government, work with our partners, Japan, Taiwan, to build resilience.
Are you getting more offers of assistance and development from China than you were, say, 2 or 3 years ago, would you say?
Well, whenever it's election season in Palau, what happens is, as you know, the president decides which countries they have diplomatic relations with. Palau's position has always been, we're friends to all, enemies to none. But no country should tell us who we can't be friends with. And our relationship with Taiwan is strong. It's been stronger than ever. Of course, China says, no, you have to denounce that relationship. And we've said, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to. That's an important partner to Palau, and we're going to continue to build on that. So China will continue to say, well, we can do this for you and we can do that. But I think Palau has been very clear that at the end of the day, what we want is we want people that respect rule of law. One of the challenges we've had in the last few years is Chinese research vessels, so-called research vessels, in our waters, uninvited, gear in the water, doing things that they shouldn't be doing in our waters. So that's a clear violation of our sovereignty and really not respecting the rule of law. And I think that's where, our people at home, although, times question, well, at the end of the day, we have to feed ourselves, but we need partners that really cherish the friendship, value the partnership, and respect our sovereignty and want to work with us as true partners. And that's what we have with the United States, Australia, Japan, and Korea, and everybody else. But other leaders in Palau in election time question those positions that we've taken. That's just the way politics is, as you know.
And that's Sarangal Whoops Jr., the president of Palau, speaking there to ABC's Sally Sara. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at our main story today. Former Solomon Islands Prime Minister Danny Phillip has full confidence in Jeremiah Manele as he starts his first week in the top job.
I know of his capacity, his intelligence, and his commitment to work. So I could see, and in fact, I encourage him to pursue a political career.
You can find those top stories on our website by simply typing Pacific Beat and Radio Australia into your search engine. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow, always at 6 a.m. PNG time. But remember, you can hear us this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. Until next time, o tua awhaatu, I'm Aggie Tupou, and you've been tuning into Pacific Beat.